It is Monday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, a top-level volcano alert affects Bali. Britain's Prince Harry is engaged to American actress Meghan Markle.
This is going to be exciting.
And Hawaii is on the front lines of preparing for a possible nuclear attack from North Korea. It's all ahead. Indonesian authorities said Monday up to 100,000 people should heed evacuation warnings around the erupting 3,000-meter-tall Mount Agung volcano on the tourist island of Bali. Only about 40,000 have heeded the call to leave from an 8 to 10-kilometer exclusion zone. The volcano alert level has been raised to its highest level, 4, as the mountain spews thick gray ash thousands of meters into the atmosphere. Bali's international airport was closed Monday, leaving thousands of tourists stranded. The volcano's last major eruption came in 1963, leaving hundreds dead. Agung has experienced more frequent tremors since September. Australian analyst Kevin Evans spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty from Jakarta.
What's interesting is that it had an attempt at blowing up a few months ago and then it cooled down. So it's really having a second go this time, but it's probably the biggest eruption from that island since March 1963.
Is it affecting a lot of people?
Actually, the smoke is blowing more to the east. And so the eastern end of Bali is islands like Lombok rather than to the west to Java. So the population affected is less than would have been the case if the smoke was blowing to the west.
It's obviously having an impact on local air traffic.
Yes, the airport in Lombok are under a lot more stress. They're closed. And there's certainly a close watch on them. And I believe flights coming from North Asia over Indonesia to Australia, some of those are being diverted around the smoke plumes.
It started off with ash rising some 9,000 meters into the air. Now apparently it's switching to deeper magmatic type of eruptions. What's involved there?
Much of the population's already been moved for its own security. So I think we'll wait to see what sort of damage is being created at this level of eruption.
This is being called similar to an eruption that this mountain had back in 1963. That's more than 50 years ago. Has it been relatively quiet since?
It has been relatively quiet. So this is the biggest eruption since that March 1963 eruption, which caused a bit more damage to people. I don't think they had quite the disaster management capacities that they've now developed.
And this is not a quick natural event. This could go on for a matter of weeks.
Yeah, I guess the science of knowing the behavior of volcanoes is a difficult one at best. But for this volcano, it really began blowing to life a couple of months ago. It slowed down a bit and now it's having a second breather. So no one, I think, really knows exactly just how far it's going to go.
Tourism apparently has been affected since the first eruptions back in September.
That would be correct. It might have affected the tourist season, I think, coming up from Australia at that time. And now it's sort of coming into another peak season, heading into the December period. So that might have a bit of an impact as well.
Indonesia has the most active volcanoes of any country in the world. Mount Singabung on the western island of Sumatra has erupted several times, most recently killing 16 in 2014 and 7 people in 2016. Time now for social media. Well, today is Cyber Monday, and you can see that because there's a hashtag saying Cyber Monday. It's a day when holiday shoppers could set a new spending record for online purchases from work, home, or anywhere with their cell phones. With rising wages in the U.S., low unemployment, and strong consumer confidence, research firm Adobe Analytics predicted shoppers could spend $6.6 billion on Monday, more than a 16% jump over last year's record-setting total. Online shopping has been increasing steadily in the U.S. for years, as many consumers stay away from traditional brick-and-mortar stores in favor of the convenience of shopping from laptop computers, handheld devices, or, to the dismay of their employers, workplace computers. Black Friday, the day after last week's Thanksgiving holiday in the U.S., is traditionally the biggest holiday shopping day of the year, coming a few weeks ahead of gift-giving at Christmas and Hanukkah. Equity firm Consumer Growth Partners estimated Friday sales, both in stores and online, at about $33 billion, a 4.8% advance over 2016. Well, also trending today is Meghan Markle. Prince Harry of the United Kingdom has announced he's marrying the American actress Meghan Markle next spring. There had been rumors of an engagement for months. Kensington Palace tweeted, "Congratulations, Prince Harry and Ms. Meghan Markle, on their engagement. His Royal Highness and Ms. Markle this afternoon visited Kensington Palace's sunken garden for a photo call to mark the happy news." Well, meanwhile, at joe.co.uk tweeted, "Breaking, successful actress Meghan Markle to wed former soldier." Well, Prince Harry did serve with the British Army in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the American news program called Good Morning America tweeted, "Meghan Markle's engagement ring was designed by Prince Harry and is composed of a trio of diamonds. The center stone is from Botswana, and the two surrounding it are from Princess Diana's collection." And that is a look at social media. Here are some of the top news stories trending. Egypt reels from the mosque attack, but Sufi Muslims still plan to honor Muhammad. Pakistan is criticized for surrendering to protest to a protesting Islamist group. Pope Francis meets Myanmar's military chief, and the U.S. targets Islamic State in an airstrike in Somalia. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA. This is International Edition on the Voice of America. Well, as we heard earlier in the program, Britain's royal family has officially announced the engagement of Prince Harry to American actress Meghan Markle. Prince Harry's father, Prince Charles, issued a statement announcing the engagement on Monday. The news led to a press stakeout at London's Kensington Palace as reporters waited for a first glimpse of the newly engaged couple, who later made an appearance for the waiting cameras. Markle showed off her engagement ring, and the couple responded to shouted questions from reporters. Markle was married briefly in 2011 to film producer Trevor Engelson, but they split 2 years later. Marlena Koenig is the author of books and articles about British and European royalty. I said to her the only other engagement of an American to a British royal was Wallace Simpson, who married the former King of England, the Duke of Windsor, in 1937.
Well, I think there's a huge difference between Meghan Markle and Wallace Simpson. For one thing, Wallace was married twice and divorced, and in the case of Meghan, she was briefly married, most likely in a civil ceremony, not in Jamaica. We think that was just the party because the divorce papers give another date for the actual wedding, and I expect it was a civil wedding probably in Los Angeles. And that really is not something that the Church of England would say, no, you can't get married in the Church of England because you had a civil wedding. So I think it's a very different situation, and the church looks very different at divorce these days. You can get married in the Church of England if you're divorced, with qualifications, and I think there'll be no problem with that. But I think it's also interesting is that she is an American, but relatively unknown in the United States. So there hasn't been this big push by the American media to find out about her, although I think now that will change.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right about that. Well, now, when they started dating, there were rumors that this was an evolving relationship, and Prince Harry put out a statement, which I think is fairly unusual when royals are dating, basically telling the press to sort of, you know, back off of her. And he also mentioned, because Ms. Markle is half African-American, that she had been subjected to some, he felt it was cruel and very racist, some of the things that were said about her.
Oh, I think that has been, especially in some of the British tabloids, Twitter, Facebook, people making really nasty racial comments because she is biracial. Her mother is African-American. Her father is white. But it really, really shouldn't matter. I mean, Harry fell in love with her. She's in love with him. And we're going to have an American princess again. And I think that is just awesome. She's also well-educated. She has a university degree. She's very much, you know, interested in charity work, which I think will suit her well within the royal family. And she already knows how to deal with publicity, you know, as an actress. And I think she will be a great asset. But I think they also need to take some time to initiate her into what it will like to be a working member of the British royal family. Because the British press can be pretty snarky.
Well, and she is marrying into a group that is, it is elite, but it's also, it can be isolated. You know, it's a very different world. And even Prince Harry's mother, who is from an aristocratic English background, mm-hmm. she found it difficult to adjust to being a member of the royal.
And in the case of Diana, she grew up as a next-door neighbor, literally. I mean, her parents were tied to the court. It's not as if she sort of didn't know what was going on. I mean, her sister dated the Prince of Wales. So there's a lot more to that that we could discuss at another time. In this case, Meghan is literally coming almost like a foreign bride. You know, how they, you know, would come over and barely know anything about the country that she's marrying into. I mean, you know, even if you're moving to the United Kingdom, they speak English, but it's still a different situation. And she's going to be followed around now by a personal protection officer for the rest of her married life. And that's not easy. You just can't pick up and do something, although you might want to.
Well, also today, there were statements. There was the announcement from Prince Charles, and there was also an announcement from the Queen and Prince Philip saying, you know, they were delighted welcoming mm-hmm. her into the family. So it seems like that the family is very much behind this.
And there just one just came out from Kensington Palace from the Cambridges.
Oh, okay. So,
They're very happy. And they're going to be neighbors because for the time being, they're going to be living in Nottingham Cottage, which is a small home on the Kensington Palace estate behind that wall.
At the moment, Prince Harry is fifth in line for the throne, and once the new royal baby is born, his brother's child, he will be sixth. So it's not likely that Prince Harry will ever become king.
No, but he still will need, because first six in line to the throne need, under the new Succession Act, will need the Queen's permission to marry. But just remember, once Dad is king, he moves back up one. This is going to be exciting. We haven't mentioned that this is the second American actress to marry a royal. The other, of course, being Grace Kelly.
Absolutely. I completely forgot about that. No one could forget about Grace Kelly, of course.
No, not at all.
But now the difference is there. She was a very famous person.
She was. I would say in the United States, she was more famous than Renier, probably right until maybe this morning. Harry was probably more famous in America than Meghan Markle.
And that's royal expert Marlena Koenig. The United Nations reports remarkable progress in containing the virus that causes AIDS. AIDS still kills, but in its latest report, UNAIDS said access to treatment has risen significantly. The UN's goal is to end the pandemic by 2030. VOA's Carol Pearson spoke to one of the world's leading scientists about whether this can be done.
Dr. Anthony Fauci has been working to end the AIDS pandemic since the 1980s, when having HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, was a death sentence. Now people with HIV can have a normal lifespan if they take their medicine as prescribed. Fauci is a world-renowned doctor at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. He says we have the tools right now to end AIDS.
What I mean is that we have extraordinarily effective drugs. But recently, those drugs have been shown over the past few years not only to save the lives of the people who take the drugs, but also to bring the level of virus in an infected person so low, below detectable level, that it makes it virtually impossible for that person to transmit the virus to someone else.
UNAIDS reports that 21 million HIV-positive people are on treatment. That's more than half of all those living with the virus. There are even drugs available to prevent those who do not have the HIV virus from getting it. But there are 16 million people infected with HIV who are not on therapy, and many of them don't know they have the disease, so they continue to spread the virus. And that's why, even with the tools we now have, Fauci doesn't see an end to AIDS.
In order to get a durable end to the epidemic, we would be greatly helped by an HIV vaccine.
A clinical trial for an AIDS vaccine took place in Thailand several years ago. That vaccine proved to be 31% effective. Compare that to the measles vaccine, which protects up to 99% of those who get vaccinated. We asked Fauci if scientists can develop an AIDS vaccine that is that good.
I don't think we're going to get there with an HIV vaccine, but even a vaccine that's 50, 55, at the most 60% effective, together with the implementation of the other advances we have, I believe we could turn around the trajectory of the epidemic and essentially end it as we know it.
Another vaccine trial is taking place in South Africa. The results won't be in for a while, and there's no way of telling if it will be good enough to help bring the epidemic to an end. Meanwhile, getting more people tested, getting more people on anti-AIDS drugs, consistent use of condoms, and limiting the number of sexual partners are the tools we have at hand to reduce the spread of AIDS. Both Fauci and UNAIDS say ending AIDS is up to the global community and how much effort and money it's willing to commit towards this goal. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. As tensions escalate between North Korea and the United States, Hawaii finds itself on the front lines in preparing for a nuclear attack. Whether or not North Korea has developed the capability of hitting the islands with a missile, state officials aren't taking any chances. Heidi Chang reports from Honolulu.
Starting in December, Hawaii will be testing its attack warning siren for the first time since the Cold War in the 1980s. The state is adding the signal to its monthly attention alert test, which warns people of an incoming tsunami or hurricane. While the wailing siren could be used to warn of a nuclear strike from North Korea, Vermiyagi, who's the administrator of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, says he thinks an attack is unlikely.
If North Korea launches against us or allies, the retaliation will be complete, and that would defeat North Korea's ambition to continue its regime. So if they did launch an attack against us, their regime would probably end.
Nevertheless, Miyagi's agency is ramping up efforts to educate the state's 1.4 million residents and also visitors on how to prepare for a nuclear attack.
Hawaii is a likely target because we're in the Pacific. We're closer into North Korea than most of the continental United States, so it's something that we need to prepare for. As we track the news and we see the tests, both missile launches and nuclear tests, you know, it's the elephant in the room. We have to consider it. We can't ignore it.
That's why the state has posted guidelines online to prepare people for a nuclear attack. It's also getting the word out through community meetings and public service announcements.
The attack warning signal advises everyone to take immediate shelter. Get inside, stay inside, stay tuned. To find out more.
World War II veteran Ted Tsukiyama recalls hearing the air raid warning sirens after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor.
Sirens were installed all over the city after the war started. And then, you know, of course, they would test them every now and then. So I remember hearing the sirens go off every now and then. The radio would give us a warning that say, this is only a test and all that. You know, don't get alarmed and all that.
Sukiyama, who's now in his late 90s, says he isn't surprised the sirens are coming back because Hawaii has long been a defense outpost. It's home to the U.S. Pacific Command, the military's headquarters for the Asia-Pacific region.
I suppose that's necessary as a precaution, but I don't think North Korea is going to try to attack. They'd be foolish to threaten South Korea or Japan or the U.S.
U.S. officials estimate a North Korean missile could reach Hawaii in about 20 minutes. It would take 5 minutes for authorities to determine its target, which would leave about 12 to 15 minutes to warn the public. Despite the state's public outreach and education efforts, Miyagi says there are still misconceptions.
The first one that I've heard is that we shouldn't prepare, we shouldn't plan, because it's never going to happen, so we're wasting our time. The second misconception is that there's no use preparing, no use planning, because if it's a nuclear attack, we're all going to die. But based on what the threat is right now, if there is an impact, you know, there will be many, many, many survivors, 80%, 90% survivors.
So Miyagi encourages everyone to have a plan and know where to shelter in place ahead of time. Officials also recommend having enough food and water to survive for 48 hours and supplies to last up to 14 days, just in case. For VOA News, I'm Heidi Chang in Honolulu.
And that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website. You can access it at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States and Tunisia have a strong partnership that is based upon mutual interests and shared values. The bilateral relationship with Tunisia extends more than 200 years, when Tunisia became one of the first countries in the world to recognize the newly formed United States. Similarly, in 1956, following Tunisia's independence, the United States was the first major power to recognize Tunisian sovereignty and establish diplomatic relations. Since that time, said Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan, our partnership has continued to grow thanks to the efforts of the Tunisian citizens who in 2011 took courageous steps to embrace democracy, human rights, and freedom as a means to achieve equality and social dignity. The United States is proud to support Tunisia's efforts to improve security, develop democratic institutions and practices, and foster economic growth. In 2017, the United States increased its development and military assistance to Tunisia by more than 30% over 2016 levels to $205.4 million. Deputy Secretary Sullivan and his Tunisian counterparts discussed the critical economic reforms and anti-corruption measures the Tunisian government is working to put into action. These reforms will bring about increased economic growth and prosperity, trade relations, foreign investment in Tunisia, and access to markets for Tunisian products. The U.S. supports Tunisia's continued efforts to encourage inclusive economic growth and improve its business climate. Discussions also focused on the importance of mutual security. We must consolidate gains against ISIS and deny safe havens to those terrorist groups who continue to probe for opportunities to regroup in North Africa and threaten the United States and our partners, including Tunisia. The recent terrorist attacks that occurred both here in Tunisia and in New York underscore the importance of our continued collaboration to ensure mutual security, which is more critical now than ever before, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. The United States looks forward to a growing relationship with Tunisia based on economic growth, security, and shared democratic values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.